Hello and welcome to Two Book Minimum, the podcast that needs to come up with a new tagline because I don't like the old one. I'm Monica Fumarolo. So remember when I accidentally took a year off from this podcast? Yeah, that wasn't my intention. 2024 was just a bit of a year, and I always had a clear vision for how I wanted to restructure this and how I wanted the podcast to go, and it just was a case of biting off more than I could chew. And since this is a hobby that only about six people listen to, it was the thing that got pushed down the list of priorities. But I'm back. I hope I have a better plan in place. I've got a notebook with ideas and lists, and I love a good list. And speaking of lists, let's talk about my favorite books of 2024. According to Goodreads and Storygraph, because I used both last year, I read 119 books, which for me is pretty average. I had some good months in the spring. Toward the end of the year, things tapered off. Like I said, life happened. But in those 119 books, I have managed to narrow it down to 10 in particular that stood out to me. These 10 are in no particular order, except for the first book, and I cannot wait to tell you more about them. They are fiction, nonfiction. I've even got a graphic novel in here. I'm really proud of myself that sticking to my reading resolutions of 2023 really exposed me to a wider range of books. And one thing I am particularly proud of is how, with my goal with this podcast, is that I want to be talking about books that generally are a little older, that aren't always at the top of book talk or on lists, but stuff that maybe has been sitting on an author's backlist for a long time, or was something that was stumbled upon by browsing library or bookstore shelves, because I do believe in the incredible value of reading books that are not immediately new or buzzing or on the bestsellers lists. Sometimes it's just about finding the right book at the right time, and that might be 20 or 30 or 100 years after it was originally published. So here are my 10 favorite books of 2024, starting off with I Who Have Never Known Men by Jacqueline Harpman. This was a book that I can tell you exactly how I heard about it. It was on the Strand Bookstore's Instagram account, and it was something that it was like a staff pick, and it absolutely blew my mind, the premise, and I'm going to tell you more about it right now. So basically, you have 39 women who live underground in a cage, and the only men in their world, or in this cage, in this cave, are the guards, who they do not speak to. None of the women have any memory of how they got there. There's no notion of time, and they vary bits and pieces recollections of their lives before they all ended up in here. And our narrator is a young girl. She's the 40th prisoner. So we have 39 grown women and a girl. To her, everything that she's experiencing is normal because there's been nothing else. This novel is her life story, looking back on her early years, but really starting in her adolescence when she starts to question the women around her and she starts to develop an imagination and ideas of her own. Now, this book first came out in 1995, and even though it is 30 years old, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm saying that, this is still so progressive and incredibly relevant given the nature of today's political climate, with the fight for women's rights, for women's health care, how people are treated. It asks such bold questions, and it makes observations about human nature that are so thought-provoking. I read this book back in July, and I haven't stopped thinking about it. I'd put it right up there with Octavia Butler's Parables of the Sower. This book, man, immediately. The other books are in no particular order, but this was my standout book of the year. Next on my list is I Have Some Questions For You by Rebecca MacKay. This came out in 2023 and was a book that got a ton of buzz, which made me both incredibly interested and highly skeptical. So this book manages to combine two things I absolutely adore: boarding schools and podcasts. So we have Bodie, who graduated from this private boarding school in New England in 1995, and then finds herself back on campus as a teacher for a few weeks in 2018. So we're in some pre-pandemic times. She doesn't exactly look back at high school fondly. It was something that she more like endured. And in fact, her senior year, a girl had been murdered. And what's kind of got Bodie particularly wrapped up in the crime is that Talia, the victim, had been her roommate the year before. They tolerated each other. They weren't friends. They were assigned. They lived together, whatever. A suspect is arrested and found guilty, but Bodie never thought that the facts of the case sat quite right. And so now that she's back at the scene of the crime for a few weeks, she's reconsidering all that happened back when she was a student and how she fit into the grander scheme of it all, particularly since one of her students has reopened the case, so to speak, for a project in producing a podcast of their own. What I really, really loved about this book and why it made the list is that it is a character study in that really none of these people are absolutely good or absolutely bad. They are all gray, they are all messy, and they are all the hero of their own story. Like, they each have main character energy in their own way. And it's also a great exercise in having an unreliable narrator realizing that she's an unreliable narrator. How memory is not always as trustworthy as she has thought it out to be. And I found that to be interesting, particularly in my own aging process and thinking back on some of my own middle school and high school years. So that book was a surprise to me, and I'm absolutely interested in reading more books from her backlist. A.J. Hackwith's The Library of the Unwritten. This is a fantasy series that was just so deeply weird and unique, and I think it is so obvious how much fun Hackwith had writing this book. And it was one of those stories where I was like, I don't know where this is going to go. And I'm not sure if the author does either, but I think I'm having fun finding out. And so is this writer. So basically the idea is that hell is a realm that human souls may go to when their time on earth is done. So they may go to heaven, they may go to hell, they may go to any number of other places. But it's important to believe here that hell isn't necessarily worse than heaven. It's just that it attracts a certain kind of clientele. A certain kind of person comes here after death. And in this case, we have Claire, who is our main character, and for a number of years has served as the head librarian of the Unwritten Wing, which is a neutral space within hell. It is a library of books that people never wrote or finished. It is wild because it's almost like the opposite of the Library of Babel, where it's any combination of every word ever written. This is all of those people who said, oh, I have an idea for a story, or they start writing it and abandon it. Those books live in this library, and her job, like any librarian on earth, is to repair and organize the books, but then the added bonus of needing to keep the characters inside the pages. They have a tendency to get out sometimes. So Claire and her crew have to retrieve items for the collection, sometimes going out into different realms. Sometimes things are brought to her. But basically, this book jumpstarts when one job goes so catastrophically sideways that all matter of beings from across the realms are now hunting for what is known as the Devil's Bible, a powerful weapon that can alter the balance of power forever. So there's all this politicking going on in the greater part of hell with all these other universes, but Claire is just trying to focus on getting this book and this character back to where they need to be. This book was a wild ride. I loved how fleshed out the characters were. Sometimes there were a lot that I had to keep track of, but I'm going to blame that more on the fact that I was reading so quickly and I just couldn't keep myself from going. As soon as I finished, there were immediately people that I was like, oh my gosh, they would read this. They would love this. And I have not picked up the sequels yet. I believe this is the first in a trilogy. I adored it. I can't wait to get back to it. I actually think I might need to reread this just so I have a clear foundation for who everyone is and how things fit together, because it fit so, so well. It was just fun. Another book that was really fun for me to read this year was a recommendation from Everyday Reading, and her name is Jansen. She is an Instagrammer and a blogger, and she had this selection for one of her book club picks this summer, and it is To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis. This is, again, a classic book, came out in 1997. It is technically the second book in a series. I did not read the first one, and I don't get the impression that you really have to read them in order. Again, this is more science fiction, but it's also historical fiction because it is a time travel story. It is also fantasy. It is also humor. It is a big one. It clocks in at 493 pages, but each and every one of them was a challenge and a delight. We have this guy, Ned, who is a time traveler as his occupation. He has been working as hard as his coworkers, and they are searching history around the clock to meet their obsessive boss's demands. And she is a billionaire, it seems, in the future, who is obsessed with rebuilding and recreating the Coventry Cathedral in England to exactly how it was right before it was bombed during World War II. She has this like personal connection to it, or she's just like really into it. It doesn't really matter to Ned and his coworkers. They just know they need to get this done because she wants it done by a certain time. And his assignment is to determine if this item known as the Bishop's Bird Stump was actually in the cathedral at the time of the bombing. It's ridiculous. You don't even really know what a bird stump is, but he has been doing so much work trying to find out this thing that he has developed a sort of jet lag. It's called time lag. It's basically a time traveling sickness, and he is ordered to take 2 weeks rest in the Victorian era to relax, to get away from technology, to get away from the jobs, away from the people. Slight problem, as soon as he gets there, he has to help a fellow time traveler who is assigned to this period doing research on the cathedral fix a very, very costly mistake. Like, if they don't fix this, they could change the course of history. So no relaxing for Ned is in sight. He and Verity are caught up in a comedy of errors. It is people misunderstanding, and part of that is because Ned is so tired, and part of it is because he's in a time period he wasn't like properly briefed for, of a guy who just needed a break and couldn't catch one. And I identified with that deeply when I read this in the spring. And again, this is something cozy I can absolutely see myself reading in the future, and I am eager to go back and explore book one in this series someday, which is called the Oxford Time Travel Series. And again, that's by Connie Willis. The newest piece of fiction on this list that I have is The Lost Story by Meg Schaefer. Now, she also wrote The Wishing Game, which I absolutely adored in 2023. So when this one came out in July, I was immediately in. I knew I had to read it. So this is more fantasy, magical realism, in a way like Maggie Stiefvater vibes, but almost more gentle or painterly. In the woods of West Virginia, 15 years ago, two best friends went missing, and they come out of the woods 6 months later. One of the boys has a back full of scars and absolutely no recollection what happened during all the time that they were gone, and the other boy won't say what happened during that time. So Rafe, the boy with scars, has become a bit of a recluse. He lives alone in a cabin. He creates the most amazing art from his dreams, and he has no idea where this stuff comes from. Jeremy, on the other hand, the boy who wouldn't talk about what happened, still won't talk about it, but he has made a name for himself due to his ability to find others who have gone missing. He's the lost boy who now finds lost boys. And when this girl, Emily, contacts Jeremy asking for his help to locate her sister who went missing in the same woods that he did 15 years ago, the time has finally come for Jeremy to come clean and share his story and share the story with Rafe, because Rafe still has no idea what was going on in that time. In a word, this book was so enchanting. There were these beautiful world-building and fantasy elements that were charming and whimsical, but just like with Meg Schaefer's previous novel, it was not sunshine and rainbows all the time. Every person in this story has a cross to bear, has a secret. Each of the protagonists' points of view is thoughtfully explored and put at the center of the focus in different chapters and handled with just such care. And it was just lovely to see how so many of these characters were, yes, in the same world and in some ways experiencing the same thing, but just in such wildly different ways. Actually, now that I think about it, it gives me early Once Upon a Time, the TV show vibes, like the early seasons before it kind of went really off the rails, where you have the reality that some characters are based in and the fantasy story that is within. I adored this. Meg Schaefer has quickly become one of my favorite authors. I'm obsessed. I cannot wait to see what more comes from that amazing imagination of hers. It's interesting now that I'm looking at this list again how there was the theme of time and travel and journey in stories, and how the other five books on my list are all nonfiction and all very interesting, different types of nonfiction. One of my resolutions last year was to read more of it, and I'm so glad that I did, and I'm so glad that so much of it made the list. One book that has been on my list for a long time and was a particularly meaningful read for me during the election season was What Unites Us by Dan Rather. I remember my parents watching Dan Rather on CBS Evening News when I was a kid. And this book summarizes and captures so much what I feel about being an American in this particular day and age, which is to say our relationship status it's complicated. I love my country, but I am also the first to admit lots of sins, lots of flaws, both past and present. And I do fear deeply for the future. And I think that fear does come from a place of caring. And I don't feel like my country always loves me back. So if I feel that way at 36, just imagine how it is for folks like Dan Rather, who is a noted journalist and has been on the front lines of American history reporting on it since 1950. So this book came out originally in 2017, so right after different presidential election, and we are now sitting on the precipice of that same individual taking back the Oval Office. And it's uncertain times to be sure. But regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, I think this book is powerful. And it reflects on what does it really mean to be patriotic, which is a word that has been hijacked and reformed and redefined and claimed by some people and had to be rejected by others. So this book is breaking things down into five major categories of things that unite us: freedom, community, exploration, responsibility, and character. And then each of those five categories is broken down into three areas of focus. So, okay, you basically have a 15 chapter book, and these are small, digestible chapters in very plain spoken, typical Dan Rather's signature style. He never speaks down to the reader and he acknowledges his own biases. So if you're someone who is just like, I politically am so different from Dan Rather, he acknowledges his own bias and how that plays into his points of view. But he also does a really great job explaining how his own background comes into things and how his experiences in journalism color other things. And I think his providing context and honesty about how that influences him is incredibly refreshing, because we don't often get that from journalists still in 2025. So this book very much reflects his left-leaning views, but he's grasping for common ground here. And I think he does a really successful job in finding it. Things that people can you say, we do agree on this. It is a tragedy that these concepts have to be so broad in order to find that common ground. But I am confident that even if my nation's leaders and elected officials can't always get there, maybe on the backs of us ordinary citizens, we can find that common ground and make our nation a little bit stronger and a little bit more united and civil in our own communities. And may that someday spread to the nation at large. You want to talk about a time when this country was united, not to say it wasn't blinded by patriotism. It may have been a little bit, but let's go back to World War II, because as me and my fellow middle school librarians say every year when we are making our Battle of the Books list, we have to have something on World War II. This is like the part of history our students are always incredibly fascinated with. And I cannot wait. I beg the universe to make a young reader's edition of this book. And it is called When Books Went to War, The Stories That Helped Us Win World War II by Molly Guptill Manning. This book, it is like a librarian's dream. I think writing a book about books is one of the hardest things people can do. And in fiction, I'm always a bit iffy on it. But here in nonfiction, Manning absolutely nailed the assignment. It came out in 2014. And I am not exaggerating when I declare I want this book to be required for everyone. Even if you say you don't like nonfiction, like, you can. You can. You need to give this one a chance. At a time, especially when like book banning and censorship is growing to an all-time high, this text showcases a time when books were not just worth fighting for, but they literally saved lives. So even before the United States was formally involved in World War II, people were paying attention to the news and they could sort of see where things were going on the international stage. So this actually starts in the 1930s when Germany was banning a whole lot of books, and they were not just banning them, they were destroying books that existed and being incredibly tight-fisted about any sort of art or difference of opinion. So instead of acting as homes for debate and learning, colleges in Germany were burning hundreds of thousands of books, cutting citizens off from any ideas or thoughts besides the ones that the Nazi government found to be acceptable. Fast forward to Pearl Harbor, and now you've got thousands of American troops are engaged in this conflict. There's no end in sight. And those in charge of the Army and Navy quickly saw the power of morale over the troops' ability to function. And when you are just training all day, or then being shipped overseas and sitting around all day when you're not fighting, you're just staring at each other, they had no escape. And so the eventual production and distribution of the Armed Services editions were born. These books were miniature precursors to what we now lovingly know as paperbacks. But here's where they were particularly brilliant. These books were small enough to fit into a soldier's pocket. And many of these soldiers credited those books with granting them a much needed mental break while they were stuck in hell on earth. It is amazing to me. And there are books we cherish as an American society today that is a direct result of this program. Have you ever heard of The Great Gatsby by one F. Scott Fitzgerald? That book was kind of a flop when it came out, but it was an armed service edition, and that's where it really got a new life, and it's been in print as a result of this program. So the topic of censorship in America gets ample coverage, particularly when you're looking at one point, there was a law that was trying to be passed saying that soldiers could not be getting political materials while they were overseas. And part of it was to try to stop them from voting for FDR in that election. But it created a case of censorship against soldiers who were fighting against censorship. Thankfully, citizens and domestic newspapers joined forces with the War Department itself. This amendment was overturned. But it's a small, hopeful example of the government being left with no option but to listen to people of this country demanding change together. So if you love books, if you love reading, if you love freedom, this is a great book for you. I mentioned up at the top that there would be a graphic novel, and I was not kidding. It is a graphic novel memoir by Theo Parrish called Homebody. This memoir is so thoughtful and easily accessible to, I got it for my middle school's library, so grades 6 and up, and is a wonderfully written example and illustrated. It's beautiful. Real illustrated example explaining Theo's life and what it has been like growing up as a non-binary person. It is something that I, as an educator in particular, want to understand better. It is something where I am so fortunate that I am cis, I'm straight. I've never had to have that experience of not feeling like my body doesn't match my identity. And this is something I want to be better informed on so that I can be a better resource to my students and a better ally to the community at large. And the ongoing metaphor in this book is about bodies being houses that we all redecorate until we are truly at home in them. This was wonderfully lovely and something I finally felt like I could wrap my hand around. I appreciate how the text and illustrations were on topic, but they're never over the top to anyone who's concerned about indoctrination or whatever. I just thought this was a beautiful example of explanation without indoctrination. It is wanting to better understand other people and how they experience this life at this time, and that not everyone has the same experience. So to try to put people in categories, in boxes that are all the same, or it doesn't serve people maybe in the way that it was once perceived to serve people. But even if you yourself are not non-binary, the overarching message of this book is about accepting yourself, how others can be accepting allies and support systems to each other. And it leaves readers just with the overall message that people deserve to be comfortable in their own skin, in their own communities, and we all deserve to be respected and to experience peace. Also, what kind of person would I be to bring up a graphic novel and not talk about the art? It's gorgeous. I'm so bad at describing it. It's the color palette is best described as berry, like pinks and blues and purples and cozy. It just unifies the whole thing. And I think the purple especially is a wonderful representation of merging blues and pinks and gender fluidity. I'm no art critic, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's where it was going. Anyway, this book is fantastic for any middle school, high school, I would even say public library, or if you are wanting to like better understand this topic from a person who has lived it in a way that is not preachy in any way. It's just a simple metaphor that worked really, really well. And I loved it. So great job, Theo. Can't wait to see what you come up with next. The final two books on this list absolutely go together for me because they speak loud and proud to my little millennial heart. Kate Kennedy nails it in her, I don't want to say memoir. It's more like essays, but it's One in a Millennial on Friendship, Feelings, Fangirls, and Fitting In. And she definitely pulls in her own personal experiences of someone who was born in the mid-80s and has a lot to say. I feel like now that millennials are older, maybe there's a little bit more weight that goes with our words. People are willing to listen to it a little bit more seriously. Or maybe it's just that we're old enough that we can unite and say, yeah, that's how it was, in a way that people finally realize we're not teenagers anymore. So One in a Millennial is an exploration of pop culture, nostalgia, the millennial zeitgeist, and life lessons that we learned as a result of coming of age in a truly unprecedented time. Man, what would I give for some precedented times? But it is, you know, every generation is sort of poo-pooed by the ones that came before it. I just love how Katie was able to address this in a way where, did I have all of the exact same experience as her growing up? No, of course not. This is her lens that she saw through, but she brings in so many things that were relatable or of the time. You know, AOL Instant Messenger, the purity culture that sort of invaded all pop culture that was aimed towards teens, American Girl dolls, going out tops, feminism by way of the Spice Girls. And that's just with our growing up stuff. She organizes the book into the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and now. And so really highlights how different things at each of those time periods brought out a part of us, a part of our generation. And she also does this great job of highlighting the fact that we were still coming of age at a time where people had to experience things collectively, where now we all have our own devices and we can sort of customize what we are seeing and who we're interacting with. And that was very much something that was coming up when, you know, Facebook was invented, and God, YouTube came out in 2005, which is wild. That was, you know, my junior, senior year of high school. But those things were so new, where we were still, you know, in the experience of like, oh, you're watching Grey's Anatomy. That means you are watching your TV on Thursday night. And she explores these things that are now from yesteryear, but we can still remember it and think back on it. And not necessarily that it was always the good old days, but, you know, just a collective moment of like, yeah, we all had that. We saw it together. We really did think the world was going to fall apart on Y2K. It is very interesting recording this on January 2nd and be like, yeah, remember a quarter of a century ago when we thought the world might fall apart at midnight? I don't know if kids these days, I don't know if anyone too young to remember can fully grasp how we thought the world might fall apart. And like the collective relief when it didn't, but also wildly, I'm sure there's got to be a book out there somewhere talking about how hard people worked to make sure the world did not fall apart on New Year's Day 25 years ago. Anyway, this book was laugh out loud funny. It was a great audiobook. I loved being in my car listening to this, and I would like be sad when I arrived at my destinations because I didn't want to stop listening. And one thing that's great is that Kate has a podcast. I did not know this. She has the Be There in 5 podcast, which is similarly part serious, part funny, looking more at like current pop culture, but definitely is informed by this time. So if you were also a, you know, someone who came of age in the 90s and 2000s, especially if you're a girl or you're identifying as a girl, this one's for you. And holding hands with that, I believe it was through Kate Kennedy. I don't know if it's through her Instagram or the podcast or whatever, but she led me then to my final book on my list for 2024, A Bit Much by Lindsay Rush. You maybe already know her on Instagram at Mary Oliver's Drunk Cousin. I can't tell you the last time I was seeking out poetry collections, maybe when I was watching the show Dickinson on Apple TV Plus. If you haven't read it or seen it, it's amazing. It is a bonkers reimagining of Emily Dickinson's life. But this is a poetry collection, which people might be like shuddering thinking back to high school English class. But hang with me. This is not your mother's poetry. This is not Mary Oliver's poetry. It is a humorous, so funny celebration of big millennial feelings, the truth of what it is to be alive at this age and this time for people who grew up on the internet, grew up with the internet, has a great way with wordplay, with witticisms, with incorporating modern and nostalgic song lyrics, crafting things into a little like story in your pocket. Just, I kept nodding along being like, yeah, that is what it feels like. So much so to the point where I have started writing poetry again, which is something I never thought I would say past the age of 17. Is it cringy? Yes. Do I love it? Also, yes. This is her debut collection. I really, really hope it is not the last. It was just so comforting to read them and be like, oh my gosh, it wasn't just me, or I'm not the only person who has felt that way, or she just finds a way to articulate it in a way that it scratches the itch like a good song lyric. Like, yes, that's the feeling. So a bit much is more than enough, and I can't wait for more. So that's it. Man, this has been a long chat. By the time you're hearing this, this is the edited version. I'm sure I cut out quite a bit. This is also my first time like not scripting an episode. I mean, I did go back on Goodreads, and for the books that I did write reviews of, I borrowed from what I previously thought. But I don't know. I kind of like this not super structured way of going about things. It feels a little bit more authentic and a little bit less like me trying to get on NPR, because as much as I would love that, I don't think they'll be calling me anytime soon. So that's it. That has been 10 of the many, many books I did honestly love last year. I will be coming back with more consistent episodes. It's not going to be another year until you hear from me. And until next time, you can like, you can subscribe, you can follow me on Instagram at 2two.book.minimum. And until next time, happy reading.